This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Stephanie Daniel. Aside from federal employees, more and more people are being impacted by what is now the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. The already stressful world of air travel is feeling the pinch, too. TSA workers are among employees expected to work without pay, and so a lot of them are calling in sick. We'll hear more about how things are going at Denver International Airport.
Thousands of Coloradans are expected to rally for the third Women's March over the weekend. Now, that's women spelled with an X instead of an E, which is to signal the intention to welcome all marginalized communities.
There are a lot of people on the gender spectrum that are experiencing sexism, and we wanted to signal to them that their voices are incredibly welcome with us.
We'll hear from one of the organizers of the event and find out how it's managed to grow from a march into a movement.
Plus, if you're like a lot of people these days, your waking life and maybe even your sleep is being affected negatively by too much social media. We'll get some tips on how to make a digital detox work for you.
And our film critic, Harry Moshevitz, fills us in on a unique film series at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
But first, Colorado Governor Jared Polis teased some ambitious goals in his State of the State address last week. This week, he outlined how he plans to pay for some of them. One of his priorities is for the state to spend $227 million from its general fund to pay for full-day kindergarten at any school district that wants to offer it. Now, right now, the state only pays for half a day of kindergarten. Polis says the state can afford to start paying for it next school year thanks to stronger-than-expected revenue projections. Republicans and Democrats who serve on the Joint Budget Committee are questioning whether that plan is sustainable, though. They point out that it's still early in the legislative session and that there are lots of other priorities competing for the money, like transportation. In addition to the kindergarten funding, Polis's budget proposal would fund 5 new oil and gas inspectors and allow the state to start importing prescription drugs from Canada. The partial shutdown of the federal government began December 22nd, and it is now the longest shutdown ever. And it's affecting the lives of hundreds of thousands of people who have been told to stay home or who are working without pay.
And, you know, nationwide, the number of furloughed employees filing for unemployment topped 10,000 during the first week of January.
Yikes.
Yeah. The Labor Department says normally fewer than 1,000 federal workers seek unemployment benefits each week.
That's a huge jump.
It is.
Now, Colorado is pretty far from Washington, D.C., but the impacts of the shutdown are hitting our state's workforce as well. More than 2,000 federal workers in Colorado have applied for unemployment since the shutdown began. Most of them are in Jefferson County, but a large number also work in Boulder, Larimer, and Weld counties.
KUNC reporter Matt Bloom has been asking for stories from impacted federal employees and contractors in northern Colorado.
My name is Isabella Oleksa. I'm a research ecologist at Colorado State University, and I'm working on my doctorate in the ecology program. I spend my summers in Rocky Mountain National Park collecting data on water quality and algae. I am in kind of a unique situation. Although I'm a PhD student, my salary comes from the federal government, so I'm a student contractor through the U.S. Geological Survey. And so during the government shutdown, I'm not getting paid, and I likely won't receive back pay as a federal contractor. And so while I'm continuing to do the work that I need to do to advance my doctorate and get my degree, it's pretty disheartening, and honestly, morale is low for me and also people like me who are in a similar situation at Colorado State University. Classes start at CSU next week, and so this semester I have a light teaching load. I'm only teaching one class, but yeah, I'm not getting paid for it, which is kind of messed up. So I'm not really sure at this point what's going to happen with that.
And we'll hear the voices of some other furloughed federal employees throughout the episode.
As federal workers continue to work without pay because of the partial government shutdown, travelers flying in and out of Denver International Airport could see longer lines and fewer flights.
Josh Wagner is the president of Denver's National Air Traffic Controllers Association. He told KUNC's Scott Franz that his members could reach a tipping point if they miss another paycheck and that safety will be compromised if the shutdown continues.
What are you hearing from workers?
The shutdown is affecting us negatively just in a morale
way, first of all, because we're not getting paychecks and still having to come to work, and nobody likes to do that. But also, when you add that level of financial stress onto the amount of work stress that you already have, plus if you have any health and wellness issues with your family that you're worrying about, I mean, it just kind of compounds, and that's not something that air traffic controllers should have to worry about when they're going to work.
Why are workers still coming in? Why are they working without pay?
I mean, federal jobs have always been considered good jobs, and I think this shutdown is kind of highlighting the fact that maybe they're not as good as everybody thought they were, but they still come with a health benefits package and a pension package, and so those are things that people have had, and that if they walk away from that, you know, you're not going to get that back. So that's, I mean, that's there, but plus, you know, we're professionals. We have a job to do, so we know, you know, we hope we'll get paid at some point in the near future, and we're just going to keep coming to work and doing our job as safely as we can.
What happens if this stretches on another month?
Well, I mean, the impacts are far-reaching already, just because right now the safety, redundancy, and support workers that we normally have are not coming to work. So you have where we would normally have our airspace and procedures support. They're not there. Our quality assurance, quality control, not there. Training department support, they're gone. Aircraft certifications, gone. And on top of that, you've closed down the training academy in Oklahoma City. And so the FAA's hiring goals each year are based on how many people they can put through Oklahoma City. You shut that down for a month or 2 months or 3 months. It takes years to recover from that. And that's the main pipeline into the career field. So we're already at a 30-year low for controller staffing. 20% of them are eligible to retire, which this government shutdown may force some of those people to just decide to retire. And now you've shut down the pipeline to replace those people. You can only imagine how far-reaching those implications are going to be.
We see lots of travelers walking around here today. Should they be concerned about the impacts of this shutdown at this point?
Like I said, we'll continue to do our job as safely as we can. What they need to be concerned about is the fact that those safety redundancy layers are being peeled back and they're not there. So, you know, whereas there's normally multiple layers of safety built into the system, there's not as many layers right now. And all of our equipment upgrade programs have been shut down. All of our technological upgrade projects have been shut down. And all of those are just designed to make the system more efficient and safer so that the people flying, you know, can get to and from where they're going quicker.
Josh Wagner is the president of Denver's National Air Traffic Controllers Association. He spoke to KUNC's Scott Franz on January 14th.
Hi, my name is Erin Berryman, and I'm a federal contractor for the U.S. Forest Service in Fort Collins, Colorado. Since I'm a contractor, it is a little different for me. We are not allowed to work on the contract during this shutdown. But instead of taking leave without pay right away, my company is having me take up all my saved vacation time to get through this so that I can still have a paycheck. But now that I've used up all my vacation time, I'm looking at taking leave without pay next, and I will have to file for unemployment. So when that happens, I'm going to have to also pay for my health insurance premium out of pocket. A big downside of using up all my vacation time is that I'm having to cancel vacations that I had planned to take later in the year. And our savings is going to take a big hit once I go on unemployment. My husband and I have a mortgage, we have two car payments, and we both still owe student loans. I feel helpless. I don't feel like it's fair that we have to suffer, and I don't think it's right to expect federal employees and federal contractors to always be prepared to be out of work like this. I think it really affects morale.
Control of the U.S. House of Representatives came down to a small number of races in last year's midterm elections. In those contests, money from special interest groups set an interesting new record that included one race in Colorado. I talked with KUNC reporters Lee Patterson and Michael DeJuana about the impact. In the 6th Congressional District, Democrat Jason Crow defeated five-term Republican Mike Kaufman. It was a very competitive race, one that you covered, Lee.
This was a district that Democrats had their eyes on for a couple of election cycles. It covers the Aurora area, which is east of Denver, And this time around, guns became a big issue, especially for Democrat Jason Crow. Gun safety was a central theme of his campaign. And gun safety groups, gun control groups, spent a lot of money to help him get elected.
And Michael, you looked into just how much money went into that race from all kinds of special interests.
Right, Aaron. As Lee mentioned, gun control groups, and we'll say more about that in a minute. But first, here's the big picture. While Crow and Kaufman spent about $9.3 million on their own campaigns collectively, they were outspent by these outside groups. $11.7 million flowed in from super PACs and so-called dark money groups, and that's money that's meant to influence the outcome of the election.
Now, super PACs are these large political action committees, but dark money?
Yeah, I know it sounds jargony, but both groups can collect unlimited money. The difference is super PACs are required to disclose who gave the money, and dark money groups, they don't have to do that. I should add that dark money was more of a factor in other races around the country. It accounted for less than a tenth of what was spent in the Crow-Kaufman matchup.
And just how much did the super PAC spend in the race?
The Republican Aligned Congressional Leadership Fund reported spending about $2.4 million in favor of Kaufman. The gun violence prevention group called Giffords PAC, they spent about $1.5 million.
One of the Giffords TV ads that aired leading up to the election, it showed a mother and daughter texting. The daughter's at school and she's texting her mom saying, "Mom, there's someone with a gun."
The NRA has given Mike Kaufman more money than any other Colorado member of Congress. Mike Kaufman's NRA rating, A.
Giffords. The Giffords PAC was started by former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who, as you might remember, she was shot in the head in 2011. She did survive. This group spent millions on competitive races with the ultimate goal, flipping the U.S. House of Representatives and really sending lawmakers to Washington who will advocate for gun safety and, you know, gun violence prevention legislation.
My name is Jason Crow, and I've come here to win this race and to move forward on gun violence prevention in this country.
And Crow, as we know, went on to win that race. As for Mike Kaufman, I'm curious, what did he think about the outside money flowing into his district?
Well, he said outside spending made it tougher to get out his own message.
Obviously, for outside groups spending money allegedly to help you, you don't control that message because you can't coordinate with him. And then conversely, I think that your opponent doesn't control what the outside groups do, spending money against you. And I think there's a lack of transparency in that process.
And Jason Crow appears to agree. Earlier this month, he joined onto a bill that aims to reduce the influence of big money in politics. That could tackle the issue of who's behind the dark money. And maybe this goes a little bit to Kaufman's point. There are 223 co-sponsors. I should add, though, that they're all Democrats.
Mm. And now, money isn't everything in a political race. Kaufman was very clear when he said that his biggest number one problem in the end was President Trump.
Even though he didn't campaign in Colorado, it was like he was in everybody's living room every day, you know, making news on these rallies that he was holding. And so it was impossible because of that, I would say, more than anything else, to get my message out to the voters.
So, Michael, I want to come back to the fact that all of this special interest money set a record, a big one.
Yeah. First of all, there were 16 races across the country, like the 6th Congressional District, where more super PAC and dark money was spent than the candidate's own campaigns. And that's a record, according to the nonpartisan nonprofit election watchdog group Issue One. The group's research manager, Michael Beckel, says this all goes back to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Since that 2010 Citizens United decision, there have been 48 congressional races in which non-candidate, non-party groups like super PACs and dark money groups have outspent the candidates. And one-third of that total occurred in 2018.
So it's never too early to look ahead to 2020. What do you think might happen?
Money's going to be an issue. And Republican Senator Cory Gardner is up for re-election. So that's going to be a hot race because it's going to coincide with the next presidential race. And based on my experience and what our listeners have obviously been hearing day after day, the next race is probably going to attract a big crowd.
Well, thank you both so much for your insights.
Thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome.
That thousands of people are expected to fill the streets of Denver for this year's Women's March on Saturday. It's the third year for the worldwide event. The first was mostly a response to the election of President Donald Trump. Since then, it's grown from a one-day march into more of a movement. Angela Astle is part of the leadership team for Denver's march. She spoke with KUNC's Kyra Buckley.
This year, what are you marching for?
We are marching for all of the voices that have not been heard. We are marching for communities that are marginalized and don't necessarily have the opportunity to speak and tell their stories. We are marching for every single issue that we personally are passionate about, because the reality is that I look at this, and as does my leadership team along with me, like, this is a movement. This isn't just this one march that we do for this one particular topic. This is really about creating a difference in our lives, like, for the future. And the way that I think we do that is that we continue to hold space and hear from all of the issues that women are impacted with.
Denver has decided to spell woman as W-O-M-X-N this year. Can you tell me why?
We intentionally changed the E to the X because we believe that the X represents a spectrum, and that gender is a spectrum. And we wanted to show invitation to anyone who is part of that spectrum is welcome to us, to join us. The other thing that X represents is that all of us are marching. A big part of why we're marching is due to experiencing some form of sexism. And that's not female-specific, that's not male-specific, there are a lot of people on the gender spectrum that are experiencing sexism, and we wanted to signal to them that their voices are incredibly welcome with us.
Have you gotten any pushback for this decision?
Oh, of course. People have expressed, mostly on Facebook, actually, as the platform of communication, but also we've had some questions in our community forums that we've held prior to the march that come up. This topic does come up. And I think some of it is, so for those that have the negative response to it, they feel like the E is being canceled out. And therefore we're canceling out women in a way, is one of the things that I've heard. And what has been interesting about that conversation is the educational piece. I think that this concept that gender is a spectrum hasn't really taken hold in our world just yet. Not because it shouldn't, but because that people haven't done the work to embrace and understand the variations of, you know, what does it mean to be male versus female versus anything else that's out there. And the fact that we've grown up in such a black and white society changes, like, your perspective is very black and white with this particular topic. And I think that we are trying to highlight that there is more than just male and female.
How would you define, or how will you define, the success of the march? Or what would make you say at the end of the day, we met our expectations, we met our goals?
The easy answer is, you know, well, 200,000 people come. So it's the biggest march than ever there was before. but in my opinion, what would success would look like is that not just the nonprofits that we're highlighting or the grassroots organizations that we're highlighting receive an outburst of support. But if we could look at how does Denver show up with the philanthropy side? And by philanthropy, I don't just mean dollars that are being given, but I mean the time that people are dedicating to show up to support our community. If there were an increase in that, because we help spread the word of the importance of it does take time, it does take conversation, it does take getting in the weeds and getting dirty, that would feel good. And I'm looking for that from a more of a story perspective. Like, I would hope that our Facebook page gets filled with people sharing stories of somebody amazing that they connected with because they came to the march.
Angela Astle is on the leadership team for Denver's Women's March. Kyra Buckley, KUNC.
The ongoing ongoing partial government shutdown is taking a toll in some unexpected places, like fighting wildfires. Even though fire season hasn't officially started yet, wildfire training courses are being canceled, and controlled burns on federal lands to thin out fire-prone forests aren't happening. Normally, the winter months are a critical time to prepare for fire season, but a lot of the work has ground to a halt on federal land because of job furloughs. Furloughed contract workers like Aaron and Isabella, who we heard from earlier in the episode, won't be eligible for back pay. Some people are filing for unemployment in that case. Full-time federal employees are scheduled to get back pay when the government reopens. But pay is not the only concern for some of them, including David Merritt.
I'm a riparian ecologist for the USDA Forest Service. I was in the middle of several projects developing in-stream flow water management plans for national forests, wilderness areas, and wild and scenic rivers. I have projects on the Snake River in Wyoming, in the Sky Island wildernesses in southern Arizona. All of this work has ground to a halt. We've been told that we cannot work even on a volunteer status during this time. So I've filled my time by doing community service for a local therapeutic horseback riding center. I've worked on some personal home improvement projects, done some hobby work, and tended to work on family business during this time. I feel remorse that the vital jobs of many of the public servants that work for the federal workforce are not recognized by the public or by decision makers as essential services. It's really difficult because we have a timeline required by Congress to file water rights for these streams to protect their outstandingly remarkable values and their wilderness values and their free functions to society. And we are basically, those projects are all mothballed right now.
We're at that point in January where some people who have made New Year's resolutions are staying with them.
For now, at least.
For now. And all this month, we're trying to help where we can with some timely advice from experts. In last week's episode, we focused on staying motivated by setting SMART goals that are measurable and timely. Today, we wanted to look at something that's plaguing a lot of us these days, an addiction to online social media.
Is that something that you struggle with?
Definitely. I usually give myself a cutoff time at night so that I don't stay up way past my bedtime catching up on the day's top news.
I do the same thing, and I try to enforce that self-imposed deadline, but
it's hard.
It doesn't always work. I know that it's affecting my sleep and just my life in general, and I know that you and I are not alone. This affects a lot of other people, too. So, I thought we'd seek some advice from Elsie Storm. She's a transformational life coach who helps her clients use a process of digital detox to break their phone addiction.
So I recently did a digital detox and I sent it to a lot of my clients. And I got these ideas from Kate Northrup, who is the author of the book Money, a Love Story. Yeah. And so here's some of the guidelines. One, no phone in your bedroom. Plug it in downstairs, plug it in somewhere else. And that's something I've been doing for years. It's really fun to like remind people you can buy alarm clocks because that's the excuse of like, I can't get up. It's my phone's my alarm. Mm-hmm. Go to Target, get an alarm clock. So, with that, the second part is no phone for the first hour of the day and no phone for the last hour of the day. So if I get up at 7, it's like, don't check my phone till 8. And if I'm going to bed at 11, you know, put my phone to bed at 10. The third is set a timer for when you're on your most addictive app. So for me, it's Instagram. The fourth is have your phone on silent when you're working, like no buzzing, et cetera. And this one's so important because we get distracted so often through our phones and it takes away from being able to get into like a deep level of deep work. And so that's really important. And then the last piece of this is all audio and on-screen notifications turned off with the exceptions of texts and phone calls. So it's like turn off any Facebook notifications, any Instagram notifications, any news notifications, and just keep the ones that are absolutely necessary for functioning. And to do it for 7 days. I think there's no better end goal than just reclaiming your time and reclaiming your life and your relationships and the things that you want to do. And happiness is in that reclaiming.
Elsie Storm is a life coach and the founder of Turning Life Gold. You can find all of these helpful tips at KUNC.org.
There's a film series in Colorado that's been around since before most of us can even remember. The International Film Series takes place on the University of Colorado campus in Boulder.
For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, it celebrates the entirety of the world of movies.
The International Film Series on the CU Boulder campus first put films on screen in 1941. That was the year of Orson Welles' astonishing first film Citizen Kane, the great Preston Sturges' comedy Sullivan's Travels, and French director Jean Renoir's first American film Swamp Water, made in the U.S. because he'd fled the Nazi occupation of France. Roger Ebert, who was a 40-year veteran of the school's Conference on World Affairs, liked to say that this was the longest continually running college film series in the country. Pablo Kielseth, the longtime curator of the series, says he's not so sure and records are scarce, but it is certain that the IFS, as it's known, has been going for 78 years, and it's still going strong. One great strength of the series is its tremendous range. IFS presents current films from the U.S. and the rest of the world, screenings of films from the past, both from the U.S. and everywhere else. And unlike most such series, IFS brings the unusual, sometimes the scorned, sometimes the kinds of films that so deviate from conventional ideas of normal that without this series and a few museums, these important films would have no place to get an audience. The current schedule includes the last unfinished film by Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind, which was completed just months ago by a team of Welles' friends and collaborators. And to lead up to that film, IFS will show three other Welles pictures, Citizen Kane, The Lady from Shanghai, and Touch of Evil. Spread throughout the semester are retrospective screenings by the great master of horror films John Carpenter, The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, The Fog, and They Live. Nicholas Roeg's The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie will show, and Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist. In the 1950s, the artist and avant-garde filmmaker Bruce Conner was a student at CU Boulder, and he started a companion series to IFS of poetic films, which he called First Person Cinema. That program has been absorbed into the International Film Series, and in the coming months will bring to the Boulder campus in-person shows by Malina Slom and Irene Lustig. On the schedule are many new films, including Hirokazu Koreeda's magnificent Shoplifters and the South Korean film Burning. You simply cannot see most of what IFS has on tap anywhere else in the area. The schedule includes restorations and even some screenings in 35mm, which is impossible to see anywhere else in these parts, and is still a more luminous experience than the digital formats. Yes, most of what the IFS shows you can find on the internet, but for good cinema, the internet or your DVD or Blu-ray player at home are second-rate substitutes. In this series, you can see the world's best movies on a big screen with an audience of human beings who are mostly strangers to each other. That setting's become a largely forgotten part of the movies, and it's one of film's most wonderful mysteries. When a movie catches the audience, you can feel it. It's electric. Or, sometimes in a movie theater, you have the experience of seeing a terrific film and then catching the eye of someone nearby, someone you don't know. And you both understand that something transcendent has just happened. You probably won't talk, but you will both know that you've shared something important with another human being. Frankly, most mainstream movie theaters and most movies are just a lot of noise. And the noise is pretty much the same for most of those films. The mainstream theaters also avoid a good chunk of the films that get to people, stir their hearts, and engage their thoughts. The cinema's big. It encompasses the world. Give it a shot. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. Thank you. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Stephanie Daniel. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org, or you can do that wherever you get podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.